to see, and Roman Catholicism, though she could write a good paper about it, was like Mohammedanism, a complex, closed-off structure. A Protestant church was a place of the other religion, the thing she would be if she weren't a Jew. Coming into one, she trod hostile territory. Rhoda didn't make quite enough room for her in the pew, and Natalie had to push her a little, murmuring an excuse to step clear of the aisle. All around, women wore bright or pastel colors. Officers and air cadets in white and gold abounded. And there Natalie stood at a May wedding in black linen, hastily selected out of a vague sense that she was still in mourning and didn't belong here. People peered at her and whispered. It wasn't her imagination. They did. How charming and fine the church was, with its dark, carved wooden ceiling arching up from pink stone walls, and what stunning masses of flowers. How pleasant, comfortable, and normal to be born an Episcopalian or a Methodist, and how perfect to be married this way. Perhaps A.J. was right, and encouraging Byron had been irresponsible. Leslie Sloat was an arid, bookish pagan like herself, and they had even talked of being married by a judge. The robed minister appeared, book in hand, and the ceremony began. As the bride paced down the aisle on the congressman's arm, moving like a big, beautiful cat, Rhoda started to cry. Memories of Warren as a little boy, memories of her own wedding, of other weddings, of young men who had wanted to marry her, of herself, a mother before 20 of the baby who had grown into this handsome groom, flooded her mind. She bowed her head in the perky hat and brought out the handkerchief. For the moment, she lost her awareness of the melancholy Jewish girl in black beside her, and even of Palmer Kirby, towering above people 3 rows back. When Victor Henry softly took her hand, she clasped his and pressed it to her thigh. What fine sons they had, standing up there together. And Pug stood slightly hunched, almost at attention, his face somber and rigid, wondering at the speed with which his life was going, and realizing again how little he allowed himself to think about Warren, because he had such inordinately high hopes for him. Standing up beside his brother, Byron felt many eyes measuring and comparing them. Warren's uniform and the other uniforms in the church troubled him. His Italian suit, with its exaggerated lines beside Warren's naturally cut whites, seemed to Byron as soft and frivolous as a woman's dress. As Janice lifted her veil for the kiss, she and Warren exchanged a deep, knowing, intimately amused glance. "How are you doing?" he murmured. "Oh, still standing up. God knows how, you dog." And with the minister beaming on them, they embraced, kissed, and laughed, there in the church in each other's arms, over the war-born joke that would last their whole lives, and that nobody else would ever know. Cars piled up in front of the beach club, only a few hundred yards from the La Couture house, and a jocund crowd poured into the canopied entrance for the wedding brunch. "I swear I must be the only Jew in Pensacola," Natalie said, hanging back a little on Byron's arm. "When I walk through that door, I'm going to set off gongs." He burst out laughing. "It's not quite that bad." She looked pleased at making him laugh. "Maybe not. I do think your mother might be a wee bit happier if a wall had fallen on me in Warsaw." At that moment, Rhoda, half a dozen paces behind them, was responding to a comment by a Washington cousin that Byron's girl looked striking. "Yes, doesn't she? So interesting. She might almost be an Armenian or an Arab. Byron met her in Italy." Champagne glass in hand, Byron firmly took Natalie around the wedding party from room to room, introducing her. "Don't say I'm your fiancée," Natalie ordered him at the start. Let them think what they please, but don't let's get into all that. She met Captain Henry's father, an engineer retired from the lumber trade, a short, withered, upright man with thick white hair, who had traveled in from California and who looked as though he had worked hard all his life, and his surprisingly fat brother, who ran a soft drink business in Seattle, and other Henrys, and a knot of Rhoda's kin, Grovers of Washington. The clothes, the manners, the speech of the Washington relatives set them off not only from the California people, but even from La Couture's Pensacola friends, who by comparison seemed a Babbity lot. Janice and Warren came and stayed, joking, eating, drinking, and dancing. Nobody would have blamed them, in view of their limited time, for vanishing after a round of handshakes, but they evinced no impatience for the joys of their new state. Warren asked Natalie to dance, and as soon as they were out on the floor, he said, "I told Byron this morning that I'm for you. That was sight unseen. Do you always take such blind risks? A flyer should be more prudent." "I know about what you did in Warsaw. That's enough." "You're cheering me up. I feel awfully out of place here." "You shouldn't. Janice is as much for you as I am. Byron seems changed already," Warren said. "There's a lot to him, but nobody's ever pressed the right button. I've always hoped that someday a girl would, and I think you're the girl." Rhoda Henry swooped past, champagne glass in hand, and gathered them up to join a large family table by the window. Possibly because of the wine, she was acting more cordial to Natalie. At the table, La Couture was declaring, with relish for his own pat phrases, that the president's request for 50,000 airplanes a year was "politically hysterical, fiscally irresponsible, and industrially inconceivable." Even the German Air Force didn't have 10,000 planes, all told, and it didn't have a single bomber that could fly as far as Scotland, let alone across the Atlantic. $1 billion! The interventionist press was whooping it up, naturally, but if the debate in Congress could go on for more than a week, the appropriation would be licked. "We have 3,000 miles of good green water between us and Europe," he said. "And that's better protection for us than 500,000 airplanes. Roosevelt just wants new planes in a hurry to give to England and France. But he'll never come out and say that. Our fearless leader is slightly deficient in candor."
"You're willing to see the British and French go down, then?" Pug Henry said.
"That's how the question's usually put," said La Couture. "Ask me if I'm willing to send 3 million American boys overseas against the Germans so as to prop up the old status quo in Europe, because that's what this is all about, and don't ever forget it."
Palmer Kirby put in,
"The British Navy's propping up our own status quo free of charge, Congressman. If the Nazis get hold of it, that'll extend Hitler's reach to Pensacola Bay."
La Couture said jovially,
"Yes, I can just see the Rodney and the Nelson right out there flying the swastika and shelling our poor old beach club."
This raised a laugh among the assorted in-laws around the table, and Rhoda said,
"What a charming thought!"
Victor Henry said,
"This isn't where they'll come."
"They're not coming at all," La Couture said. "That's New York Times stuff. If the British get in a jam, they'll throw out Churchill and make a deal with Germany. But naturally they'll hang on as long as they think there's a chance that the Roosevelt administration, the British sympathizers, and the New York Jews will get us over there."
"I'm from Denver," said Kirby, "and I'm Irish."
He and Victor Henry had glanced at Natalie when La Couture mentioned the Jews.
"Well, error is contagious," said the congressman with great good nature, "and it knows no boundaries."
This easy, amused war talk over turkey, roast beef, and champagne, by a broad picture window looking out at beach umbrellas, white sand, and heeling sailboats, had been irritating Natalie extremely. La Couture's last sentence stung her to say, in a loud voice, "I was in Warsaw during the siege." La Couture calmly said,
"That's right, so you were, you and Byron. Pretty bad, was it?"
"The Germans bombed a defenseless city for 3 weeks. They knocked out all the hospitals but one, the one I worked in. The wounded were piled up in our entrance hall like logs. In one hospital, a lot of pregnant women burned up." The table became a hole of quiet in the boisterous party. The congressman spun an empty champagne glass between two fingers.
"That sort of thing has been going on in Europe for centuries, my dear. It's exactly what I want to spare the American people."
"Say, I heard a good one yesterday,"
spoke up a jolly-faced man in steel-rimmed glasses, laughing.
"A.B. and his family, see, are driving down to Miami, and about Tampa they run out of gasoline. Well, they drive into this filling station, and this attendant says, 'Juice?' And old A.B., he says, 'Well, what if we are? Don't we get no guess?'"
The jolly man laughed again, and so did the others. Natalie could see he meant no harm. He was trying to ease the sober turn of the talk. Still, she was very glad that Byron came up now and took her off to dance. "How long does this go on?" she said. "Can we go outside? I don't want to dance." "Good. I have to talk to you." They sat on the low wall of the terrace in blazing sun, by stairs leading to the white sand, not far from the picture window, behind which La Couture was still holding forth, shaking his white-thatched head and waving an arm. Byron leaned forward, elbows on knees, fingers clasped together. "Darling, I think I'm getting organized here. I may as well fly up to New London today or tomorrow and take that physical, so that—" "What's the matter?" A spasm had crossed her face.
"Nothing, go on. You're flying to New London."
"Only if you agree. I'll do nothing that we both don't concur on, from now on and forever." "All right." "Well, I take the physical. I also check the situation and make very sure that a married applicant has a chance, and that if he's admitted, he gets to spend time with his wife. That takes care of our first few months, maybe our first year. I'll eventually go to one submarine base or another, if I get through, and you'll come along, the way Janice is doing. We all might end up at Pearl Harbor together. There's a university in Hawaii. You might even teach there."
"Goodness, you've been thinking with might and main, haven't you?"
Victor Henry came through the doors to the terrace. Byron glanced up and said coolly and distantly, "Hi, looking for me?"
"Hi. I understand you're driving Madeline to the airport. Don't leave without me. I just talked to Washington, and I've got to scoot back. Your mother's staying on."
"When's the plane?"
Natalie said.
1:40.
"Can you lend me some money?" she said to Byron. "I think I'll go to Washington on that plane."
Pug said,
"Oh, glad to have your company,"
and went back into the club.
"You're going to Washington?" Byron said. "Why there, for crying out loud?"
She put a cupped palm to Byron's face.
"Something about Uncle Aaron's citizenship. While you're in New London, I can take care of it." "My God, what's the matter? You look as though you've been shot."
"You're mistaken. I'll give you the fare."
"Byron, listen. I do have to go there, and it would be plain silly to fly down to Miami and then right back up to Washington. Can't you see that? It's for a day or two at most."
"I said I'd give you the fare." Natalie sighed heavily.
"Darling, listen. I'll show you Aaron's letter. He asked me to talk to Leslie Sloat about his passport problem. It's beginning to worry him."
She opened her purse.
"What's the point?" Byron stiffly stood up. "I believe you."
Warren insisted on coming to the airport, though Pug tried to protest that the bridegroom surely had better things to do with his scanty time. "How do I know when I'll see all of you again?" Warren kept saying. Rhoda and Janice got into the argument, and the upshot was that the Henrys plus the bride and Natalie all piled into La Couture's Cadillac. Rhoda, on the way out, had snatched a bottle of champagne and some glasses. "This family has been gypped by this miserable, stupid war," she declared, handing the glasses around as Byron started up the car. "The first time we're all together in how many years, and we can't even stay together for 12 hours. Well, I say, if it's going to be a short reunion, it's damn well going to be a merry one. Somebody sing something." So they sang "Bell-Bottom Trousers," and "She Wore a Yellow Ribbon," and "I've Got a Sixpence," and "Auld Lang Syne," as the Cadillac rolled toward the airport. Natalie, crowded between Rhoda and Madeline, tried to join in, but "Auld Lang Syne" was the only song she knew. Rhoda pressed a glass on her and filled it until wine foamed over the girl's fingers. "Oh, sorry, dear. Well, it's a mercy your suit's black," she said, mopping at Natalie's lap with her handkerchief. When the car drove through the airport entrance, they were singing one Natalie had never even heard, a family favorite that Pug had brought from California. "Till we meet, till we meet, till we meet at Jesus' feet. Till we meet, till we meet. God be with you till we meet again." And Rhoda Henry was crying into her champagne-soaked handkerchief, stating that these were tears of happiness over Warren's wonderful marriage. Part 2. Pamela. Chapter 27. As France was caving in, people began at last to perceive that a main turn of mankind's destiny now hung on flying machines. Of these, there were only a few thousand on the planet. The propeller warplanes of 1940 were modestly destructive compared to aircraft men have built since. But they could shoot each other down, and unopposed, they could set fire to cities far behind battle lines. Massive bombing of cities from the air had, for some years after the First World War, been considered war's ultimate and unthinkable horror. But by 1940, the Germans had not only thought of it, but had twice done it, in the Spanish Civil War and in Poland. The Japanese, too, had bombed China's cities from the air. Evidently, the ultimate horror was quite thinkable, though the civilized term for it, strategic bombing, was not yet in vogue. The leaders of England, therefore, had to face a bitter decision. Whether to send their few precious planes to fight over France against the Germans, or hold them back to defend the homeland's cities and shores. The French had even fewer planes. In the years before the war, instead of constructing an air fleet, the French had built their Maginot Line. Their military thinkers had argued that aircraft were the scouts and stinging insects of war, useful, annoying, hurtful, but incapable of forcing a decision. As the French state, under the punch of German dive bombers, flew to pieces like a Limoges vase hit by a bullet, its premier issued a sudden frantic public appeal to President Roosevelt to send clouds of airplanes. But there were no clouds to send. Maybe the French premier did not know what a paltry air force America had, or that even then no fighter plane in existence could travel more than a couple of 100 miles. The level of information among French politicians at the time was low. Meantime, over the fields of Belgium and France, British pilots had learned something important. They could knock down German flying machines. They knocked down many, but many British planes fell too. As the Battle of France went on, the French implored their retreating allies to throw in all their aircraft. This the British did not do. Their air commander, Dowding, told Winston Churchill that 25 squadrons had to be kept intact to save England, and Churchill listened to him. The French collapse thus became foredoomed, if it had ever been anything else. At the height of the debacle, on June 9th, in a letter to old General Smuts, Winston Churchill explained himself. The military sage had reproved him for failing to observe a first principle of war: concentrate everything at the decisive point. Churchill pointed out that with the short-ranged fighter planes then in the air on both sides, the side that fought nearer its airdromes had a big advantage.
"The classical principles are in this case modified by the actual quantitative data," he wrote. "I see only one way through now, to wit, that Hitler should attack this country, and in so doing break his air weapon. If this happens, he will be left to face the winter with Europe writhing under his heel, and probably with the United States against him after the presidential election is over."
Winston Churchill, today an idealized hero of history, was, in his time, variously considered a bombastic blunderer, an unstable politician, an intermittently inspired orator, a reckless self-dramatizer, a voluminous, able writer in an old-fashioned vein, and a warmongering drunkard. Through most of his long life, he cut an antic, brilliant, occasionally absurd figure in British affairs. He never won the trust of the people until 1940, when he was 66 years old, and before the war ended, they dismissed him. But in his hour, he grasped the nature of Hitler and sensed the way to beat him, that is, by holding fast and pushing him to the assault of the whole world. The morbid German dream of rule or ruin, of dominion or Götterdämmerung. He read his man, and he read the strategic situation, and with the words of his mouth he inspired the British people to share his vision. By keeping back the 25 squadrons from the lost Battle of France, he acted toughly, wisely, and ungallantly. And he turned the war to the course that ended 5 long years later, when Hitler killed himself and Nazi Germany fell apart. This deed put Winston Churchill in the company of the rare saviors of countries, and perhaps of civilizations. With France and the Low Countries overrun, and the Germans at the Channel, England now lay within range of the Luftwaffe's fighter planes. The United States was safe from air attack in 1940, but the onrolling conquest of Europe by the Germans, combined with the growing menace of Japan, posed a danger to the future safety of the United States. The question arose: if selling warplanes to the British would enable them to go on knocking down German aircraft, killing German pilots, and wrecking German bomber factories, might not that be, for American security, the best possible use of the aging craft, while new, bigger, and stronger machines were built in the inaccessible sanctuary across the ocean? The answer, from the United States Navy, the Army, the War Department, the Congress, the press, and the public, was a roaring no. Franklin Roosevelt wanted to help the British, but he had to reckon with that great American no. Churchill, with the power of a wartime chief of state, had not sent planes to France because the survival of England depended on them. Roosevelt, presiding over a wealthy, huge land at peace, could not even sell planes to England without risking impeachment. It was a shock for Victor Henry to see Franklin Roosevelt out from behind the desk in a wheelchair. The shirt-sleeved president was massive and powerful-looking down to the waist. Below that, thin seersucker trousers hung pitifully, baggy and loose, on his fleshless thigh bones and slack lower legs. The crippled man was looking at a painting propped on a chair. Beside him stood the vice chief of naval operations for air, whom Victor Henry knew well, a spare, withered little naval aviator, one of the surviving pioneers, with a lipless mouth, a scarred red face, and ferocious, tangled white eyebrows.
"Hello there!"
The president gave Victor Henry a hearty handshake, his grip warm and damp. It was a steamy day, and though the windows of the Oval Study were open, the room was oppressively hot.
"You know Captain Henry, of course, Admiral. His boy's just gotten his wings at Pensacola. How about this picture, Pug? Like it?"
Inside the heavy, ornate gold frame, a British man-o-war, under full sail, tossed on high seas beneath a storm-racked sky and a lurid moon.
"It's fine, Mr. President. Of course, I'm a sucker for sea scenes."
"So am I. But do you know he's got the rigging wrong?"
The president accurately pointed out the flaws, with great relish for his own expertise.
"Now, how about that, Pug? All the man had to do was paint a sailing ship. That was his whole job. And he got the rigging wrong. It's positively unbelievable what people will do wrong, given half a chance. Well, that thing's not going to hang in here."
During all this, the admiral was training his eyebrows like weapons at Victor Henry. Years ago, in the Bureau of Ordnance, they had violently disagreed over the deck plating on the new carriers. Junior though he was, Henry had carried his point because of his knowledge of metallurgy. The president now turned his chair away from the painting and glanced at a silver clock on his desk, shaped like a ship's wheel.
"Admiral, what about it? Are we going to put Pug Henry to work on that little thing? Will he do?"
"Well, if you assigned Pug Henry to paint a square rigger, Mr. President,"
the admiral replied nasally, with a none-too-kind look at Pug,
"you might not recognize it, but he'd get the rigging right. As I say, a naval aviator would be a far more logical choice, sir, but—"
He gestured reluctant submission with an upward chop of a hand. The president said,
"We went through all that. Pug, I assume somebody competent is tending shop for you in Berlin?"
"Yes, sir."
Roosevelt gave the admiral a glance which was a command. Picking his white hat off a couch, the admiral said,
"Henry, see me at my office tomorrow morning at 8.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Victor Henry was left alone with the President of the United States. Roosevelt sighed, smoothed his thin, rumpled gray hair, and rolled himself to his desk. Victor Henry now noticed that the president did not use an ordinary invalid's wheelchair, but an odd piece of gear, a sort of kitchen chair on wheels, in and out of which he could easily slide himself.
"Golly, the sun's going down and it's still sweltering in here."
Roosevelt sounded suddenly weary as he contemplated papers piled on the desk.
"Isn't it about time for a drink? Would you like a martini? I'm supposed to mix a possible martini."
"Nothing better, sir."
The president pressed a buzzer. A grizzled, tall Negro in a gray gabardine jacket appeared and deftly gathered papers and folders out of various trays, while Roosevelt pulled wrinkled papers from one pocket and another, made quick penciled notes, jabbed papers on a spike, and threw others in a tray.
"Let's go," he said to the valet. "Come along, Pug."
All down one long hall, and in the elevator, and down another hall, The president glanced at papers and scrawled notes, puffing at the cigarette holder in his teeth. His gusto for the work was evident, despite the heavy purple fatigue smudges under his eyes and the occasional deep coughs racking his chest. They arrived in a small, dowdy sitting room hung with sea paintings.
"That thing isn't going to end up in here either," said the president. "It's going in the cellar."
He handed all the papers to the valet, who wheeled a chromium-stripped bar beside his chair, and left.
"Well, how was the wedding, Pug? Did your boy get himself a pretty bride?"
said the president in chatty and warm, if faintly lordly tones, measuring out gin and vermouth like an apothecary. Henry thought that perhaps the cultured accent made him sound more patronizing than he intended to be. Roosevelt wanted to know about the La Couture house, and Riley laughed at Victor Henry's account of his argument with the congressman.
"Well, that's what we're up against here, and Ike La Couture's an intelligent man. Some of them are just contrary and obstinate fools. If we get La Couture in the Senate, he'll give us real trouble."
A very tall woman in a blue and white dress came in, followed by a small black dog.
"Just in time! Hello there, doggy!"
exclaimed the president, scratching the Scotty's head as it trotted up to him and put its paws on the wheelchair.
"This is the famous Pug Henry, dear."
"Oh, what a pleasure!"
Mrs. Roosevelt looked worn but energetic. An imposing, rather ugly woman of middle age, with fine skin, a wealth of soft hair, and a smile that was gentle and sweet, despite the protruding teeth stressed in all the caricatures. She firmly shook hands, surveying Pug with the astute, cool eyes of a flag officer.
"The Secret Service has an unkind name for my dog," Roosevelt said, handing his wife a martini. "They call him the Informer. They say he gives away where I am, as though there were only one little black Scotty in the world, eh, Fowler?"
"What do you think of the way the war's going, Captain?"
said Mrs. Roosevelt, straight off, sitting in an armchair and holding the drink in her lap.
"It's very bad, ma'am, obviously."
Roosevelt said,
"Are you surprised?"
Pug took a while to answer.
"Well, sir, in Berlin, they were mighty sure that the Western campaign would be short. Way back in January, all their government war contracts had a terminal date of July 1st. They thought it would all be over by then, and they'd be demobilizing."
Roosevelt's eyes widened.
"That fact was never brought to my attention. That's extremely interesting."
Mrs. Roosevelt said,
"Meantime, are they suffering hardships?"
Victor Henry described the birthday present for the Führer drive, collecting household tin, copper, and bronze. The newsreel of Göring adding busts of himself and Hitler to a mountain of pots, pans, and irons, and washtubs. The death penalty announced for collectors caught taking anything for their own use. The slogan, "One pan per house, 10,000 tons for the Führer." He talked of snowbound Berlin, the lack of fuel, the food rationing, the rule that a spoiled frozen potato had to be bought with each good one. It was against the law, except for foreigners and sick people, to hail a taxi in Berlin. Russian food deliveries were coming in slowly, if at all, so the Nazis were wrapping butter from Czechoslovakia in Russian-printed packages to foster the feeling of Soviet support. The wartime beer, a uniform brew reduced in hops and alcohol content, was undrinkable, but the Berliners drank it.
"They've got a wartime soap, too," Pug said. "Einheitsseife. When you get into a crowded German train, it's not much in evidence."
Roosevelt burst out laughing.
"Germans are getting a bit ripe, huh? I love that. Einheitsseife."
Pug told jokes circulating in Berlin. In line with the war effort speeding up, the Führer had announced that the period of pregnancy henceforth would be 3 months. Hitler and Göring, passing through conquered Poland, had stopped at a wayside shrine. Pointing to the crucified Christ, Hitler asked Göring whether he thought that would be their final fate. "Mein Führer, we are perfectly safe," Göring said. "When we are through, there will be no wood or iron left in Germany." Roosevelt guffawed at the jokes and said that there were far worse ones circulating about himself. He asked animated questions about Hitler's mannerisms in the meeting at Carinhall. Mrs. Roosevelt interjected in a sharp, serious tone, "Captain, do you think that Mr. Hitler is a madman?"
"Ma'am, he gave the clearest rundown on the history of Central Europe I've ever heard. He did it off the cuff, just rambling along. You might think his version entirely cockeyed, but it all meshed together and ticked like a watch."
"Or like a time bomb," said the president.
Pug smiled at the quick, grim joke and nodded.
"This is an excellent martini, Mr. President. It sort of tastes like it isn't there. Just a cold cloud."
Roosevelt's eyebrows went up in pride and delight.
"You've described the perfect martini. Thank you."
"You've made his evening," said Mrs. Roosevelt.
Roosevelt said,
"Well, my dear, even the Republicans would agree that as a president, I'm a good bartender."
It wasn't much of a jape, but it was a presidential one, so Pug Henry laughed. The drink, the coziness of the room, the presence of the wife and the dog, and the president's naive pleasure in his trivial skill made him feel strangely at home. The little black dog was the homiest touch. It sat worshipping the crippled president with a bright stare, now and then running a red tongue over its nose, or shifting its look inquiringly to Pug. Sipping his martini, his pose in the wheelchair as relaxed as before, but the patrician tones subtly hardening for business, Roosevelt said,
"Do you think the British will hold out, Pug, if the French collapse?"
"I don't know much about the British, sir."
"Would you like to go there for a spell as a naval observer, possibly after you've had a month or so back in Berlin?"
Hoping that Franklin Roosevelt was in as pleasant a mood as he seemed, Victor Henry took a plunge.
"Mr. President, any chance of my not going back to Berlin?"
Roosevelt looked at the naval captain for an uncomfortable 5 or 10 seconds, coughing hard. His face sobered into the tired gravity of the portraits that hung in post offices and naval stations.
"You go back there, Pug."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"I know you're a seafaring man. You'll get your sea command."
"Yes, Mr. President."
"I'd be interested in your impressions of London."
"I'll go to London, sir, if that's your desire."
"How about another martini?"
"Thank you, sir, I'm fine."
"There's the whole question of helping the British, you see, Pug."
The president rattled the frosty shaker and poured.
"No sense sending them destroyers and planes if the Germans are going to end up using them against us."
Mrs. Roosevelt said with a silvery ring in her voice,
"Franklin, you know you're going to help the British."
The president grinned and stroked the Scotty's head. Over his face came the look of complacent, devilish slyness with which he had suggested buying the Allied ocean liners. Eyebrows raised, eyes looking sidewise at Pug, mouth corners pulled far up.
"Captain Henry here doesn't know it yet, but he's going to be in charge of getting rid of those old, useless, surplus Navy dive bombers. We badly need a house cleaning there. No sense having a lot of extra planes cluttering up our training stations, eh, Captain? Very untidy, not ship-shape."
"Is that definite at last? How wonderful," said Mrs. Roosevelt.
Yes, naturally the aviators didn't want a black shoe to handle it.
Roosevelt used the slang with self-conscious pleasure.
So, naturally, I picked one. Aviators all stick together, and they don't like to part with planes. Pug will pry the machines loose. Of course, it may be the end of me, if word gets out. That'll solve the third-term question, eh? What's your guess on that one, Pug? Is that man in the White House going to break George Washington's rule and try for a third term? Everybody seems to know the answer but me.
Victor Henry said, Sir, what I know is that for the next 4 years, this country is going to need a strong commander-in-chief. Roosevelt's mobile pink face turned grave and tired again, and he coughed, glancing at his wife. He pressed a buzzer.
Somebody the people aren't bored with, Pug. A politician exhausts his welcome after a while, like an actor who's been on too long. The goodwill ebbs away, and he loses his audience.
A Navy lieutenant in dress blues with gold shoulder loops appeared in the doorway. Roosevelt offered his hand to Victor Henry.
That Sumner Wells thing didn't come to anything, Pug, but our conscience is clear. We made the effort. You were very helpful.
Aye, aye, sir.
Wells wasn't as impressed with Hitler as you evidently were.
Sir, he's more used to being around great men.
A peculiar flash, not wholly pleasant, came and went in the president's tired eyes.
Goodbye, Pug.
A crashing thunderstorm, with thick rain hissing down from skies black as night, stopped Victor Henry from leaving the White House. He waited for a let-up in a crowded, open doorway marked Press, where a cool, damp wind brought in a smell of rainy grass and flowers. All at once, a heavy hand thwacked his shoulder.
"I say, Henry, you've got yourself another stripe!"
Alastair Tudsbury, swelling in green gabardine, leaning on a cane, his mustached face purpler than before around the nose and on the cheeks, beamed down at him through thick glasses.
"Hello there, Tudsbury."
"Why aren't you in Berlin, old cock? And how's that magnificent wife of yours?"
As he spoke, a small black British car pulled up to the entrance in the streaming rain and honked.
"That's Pamela. What are you doing now? Why not come along with us? There's a little reception at the British Embassy. Just cocktails and such. You'll meet some chaps you ought to know."
"I haven't been asked."
"You just have been. What's the matter? Don't you like Pam? There she sits. Come along now."
Tudsbury propelled Henry by the elbow out into the rain.
"Of course I like Pamela,"
Henry managed to say as the father opened the car door and thrust him in.
"Pam, look whom I bagged outside the press room."
"Why, how wonderful."
She took a hand off the wheel and clasped Pug's, smiling familiarly as though not a week had passed since their parting in Berlin. A small diamond sparkled on her left hand, which before had been bare of rings.
"Tell me about your family,"
she said as she drove out of the White House grounds, raising her voice over the slap of the wipers and the drumming of the rain.
"Is your wife well? And what happened to that boy of yours who was caught in Poland? Is he safe?"
"My wife's fine, and so's Byron.
Did I mention to you the name of the girl he traveled with to Poland?"
"I don't believe you did."
"It's Natalie Jastrow."
"Natalie? Natalie Jastrow, really?"
"Knows you, she says."
Pamela gave Henry a quizzical little glance.
"Oh, yes. She was visiting a chap in your embassy in Warsaw, I should think. Leslie Sloat."
"Exactly. She went to see this fellow, Sloat. Now she and my son intend to get married, or so they say."
"Oh, bless me. Well, Natalie's quite a girl," said Pamela, looking straight ahead.
"How do you mean that?"
"I mean she's extraordinary. Intelligence? Looks?
Pamela paused.
Willpower?
A handful, you mean, Pug said, remembering that Tudsbury had used the word to describe Pamela.
She's lovely, actually, and 10 times more organized than I'll ever be.
Leslie Sloat's coming to this party,
Tudsbury said.
I know, Pamela said. Phil Rule told me.
The conversation died there, in a sudden, cold quiet. When the traffic halted at the next red light, Pamela shyly reached out 2 fingers to touch the shoulder board of Henry's white uniform.
What does one call you now? Commodore?
Captain! Captain! Boomed Tudsbury from the rear seat. 4 American stripes! Anybody knows that! And mind your protocol! This man's becoming the Colonel House of this war!
Oh, sure, Pug said. An embassy paper shuffler, you mean. The lowest form of animal life. Or vegetable, more exactly. Pamela drove skillfully through the swarming traffic of Connecticut and Massachusetts avenues. As they came to the embassy, the rain was dwindling. Late sunlight shafted under the black clouds, lighting up the pink banks of blooming rhododendron, the line of wet automobiles, and the stream of guests mounting the steps. Pamela's streaking arrival and skidding halt drew glares from several Washington policemen, but nothing more.
"Well, well, sunshine after the storm," said Tudsbury. "A good omen for poor old England, eh?" "What's the news, Henry? Did you hear anything special at the White House? Jerry is really riding hell for leather to the sea, isn't he? The teletype says he's knocked the French 9th Army apart. I do think he's going to cut the Allied line right in two. I told you in Berlin that the French wouldn't fight."
"They're supposed to be counterattacking around Soissons," Pug said. Tudsbury made a skeptical face. As they went inside and fell into the long reception line extending up a majestic stairway, he said,
"The bizarre thing to me is the lack of noise over Germany's invasion of Belgium and Holland. The world just yawns. This shows how far we've regressed in 25 years. Why, in the last war, the rape of Belgium was an earth-shaking outrage. One now starts by assuming total infamy and barbarity in the Germans. That gives them quite an edge, you know. Our side doesn't have that freedom of action, in the least."
At the head of the wide red-carpeted stairs, the guest of honor, a skinny, ruddy man of 50 or so, in a perfectly cut, double-breasted black suit with huge lapels, stood with the ambassador, shaking people's hands under a large painting of the king and queen, and now and then nervously touching his wavy blonde hair.
"How are you, Pam? Hello there, Talkie," he said.
"Lord Burnwilk, Captain Victor Henry,"
Tudsbury said. Pamela walked on, disappearing into the crowd. Duncan Burnwilk offered Pug a delicate-looking but hard hand, smoothing his hair with the other.
"Burnwilk is here to try to scare up any old, useless aeroplanes you happen to have lying around," said Tudsbury.
"Yes, best prices offered," said the ruddy man, briefly smiling at the American, then shaking hands with somebody else.
Tudsbury limped with Pug through 2 large, smoky reception rooms, introducing him to many people. In the second room, couples shuffled in a corner to the thin music of 3 musicians. The women at the party were elegantly clad. Some were beautiful. Men and women alike appeared merry. It struck Victor Henry as an incongruous scene, considering the war news. He said so to Tudsbury.
"Ah, well, Henry, pulling long faces won't kill any Germans, you know. Making friends with the Americans may. Where's Pam? Let's sit for a moment. I've been on my feet for hours."
They came upon Pamela drinking at a large round table with Leslie Sloat and Natalie Jastrow. Natalie wore the same black suit. So far as Pug knew, she had come to Washington in the clothes she stood up in, with no luggage but a blue leather sack. She gave him a haggard smile, saying, "Small world." Pamela said to her father,
"Governor, this is Natalie Jastrow, the girl who went tootling around Poland with Captain Henry's son."
Sloat said, rising and shaking hands with Tudsbury, "Talkie, you may be the man to settle the argument. What do you think the chances are that Italy will jump into the war now?"
"It's too soon. Mussolini will wait until France has all but stopped twitching. Why do you ask?"
Natalie said, "I've got an old uncle in Siena, and somebody should go and fetch him out. There's nobody in the family but me to do it."
Sloat said, "And I tell you, Aaron Jastrow's quite capable of getting himself out."
"Aaron Jastrow?" said Tudsbury with an inquisitive lilt. "A Jew's Jesus? Is he your uncle? What's the story?"
"Will you dance with me?" Pamela said to Pug, jumping up.
"Why, sure."
Knowing how much she disliked dancing, he was puzzled, but he took her hand, and they made their way through the jam toward the musicians. She said, as he took her in his arms,
"Thanks. Phil Rule was coming to the table. I've had enough of him."
"Who is Phil Rule?"
"Oh, he was the man in my life for a long time. Far too long. I met him in Paris. He was rooming with Leslie Sloat. He'd been at Oxford when Leslie was a Rhodes Scholar. Phil's a correspondent, and an excellent one, but a monster. They're much alike, a pair of regular rips."
"Really? Sloat's the brainy, quiet type, I thought."
Pamela's thin lips twisted in a smile.
"Don't you know they can be the worst? They have pressure cooker souls, those fellows."
They danced in silence for a while. She was as clumsy as ever. She spoke up cheerily.
"I'm engaged to be married."
"I noticed your ring."
"Well, it was a good job I didn't wait for that Navy flyer son of yours, wasn't it?"
"You didn't give me any encouragement, or I might have worked on it."
Pamela laughed.
"Fat lot of difference that would have made. And Natalie really has your other boy, has she? Well, that's the end of the available Henrys, then. I made my move in good time."
"Who is he, Pamela?"
"Let's see. Ted's rather hard to describe. Teddy Gallard, from an old Northamptonshire family. He's nice-looking, and rather a lamb, and a bit mad. He's an actor, but he hadn't got too far when he joined the RAF. He's only 28. That makes him fairly ancient for flying. He's in France with a hurricane squadron."
After another silence, Pug said,
"I thought you didn't like to dance, especially with Americans."
"I don't, but you're so easy to dance with and so tolerant. The young ones are now doing an insane thing called the shag. One or two have got hold of me and fairly shagged my teeth loose."
"Well, my style is straight 1914.
"Possibly that was my year, or should have been. Oh, dear,"
she said, as the music changed tempo and some of the younger couples began hopping up and down.
"Here's a shag now."
They walked off the dance floor to a purple plush settee in the foyer, where they sat under a bright, bad painting of Queen Mary. Pamela asked for a cigarette and took several puffs, leaning an elbow on her knee. Her low-cut dress of rust-colored lace partly showed a small, smooth, white bosom. Her hair, which on the Bremen had been pulled back in a thick bun, hung to her shoulders now in glossy brown waves.
"I have a yen to go home and enlist in the WAFs."
He said nothing. She cocked her head sideways.
"What do you think?"
"Me? I approve."
"Really? It's rank disloyalty, isn't it? Talkie's doing a vital service to England here."
"He can get another secretary. Your lucky RAF man is there."
She colored at the word lucky.
"It's not that simple. Talkie's eyes do get tired. He likes to dictate and to have things read to him. He keeps weird hours, works in the bathtub and so forth.
Then he'll have to indulge his eccentricities a bit less.
But is it right just to abandon him?
He's your father, Pamela, not your son. Pamela's eyes glistened at him.
Well, if I actually do it, we shall have Tudsbury in Lear for a week or two. How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. I think the governor will rather enjoy throwing himself into the part at that. Perhaps we should return to him now, Captain Henry.
He said as they stood and walked to the main reception room, "Why not call me Pug, by the way? Everybody does who knows me."
"Yes, I heard your wife call you that. What does it mean?"
"Well, at the Naval Academy, anybody named Henry usually gets called Patrick, the way a Rhodes gets labeled Dusty. But there was a Patrick Henry in the class above me, and I was a freshman boxer, so I got tagged Pug."
"You boxed?"
Her glance traveled across his shoulders and arms.
"Do you still?"
He grinned. "Kind of strenuous. Tennis is my game, when I can get around to it."
"Oh, I play fair tennis."
"Well, good. If I ever get to London, maybe we can have a game."
"Are you—" She hesitated. "Is there any chance of your coming to London?"
"It's not impossible. There they are, way down there," Pug said. "Gosh, this room's mobbed."
"Natalie seems miserable," Pamela said.
Pug said,
"She just lost her father."
"Oh, I didn't know that. Well, she's grown more attractive, that's sure. Definitely marrying your boy, is she?"
"It seems so. Maybe you can give me advice on that one. I feel she's too old for him, too smart for him, and just about everything else is wrong with it. Except that they're crazy about each other, which is something but not everything."
"Maybe it won't come off. There's many a slip,"
Pamela said. "You never have met Byron. You'd see in a minute what I mean if you did. He's really still a baby."
She mischievously glanced at him and tapped his arm. "You do sound fatherly at that."
Tudsbury and Sloat were in a lusty argument, with Natalie looking somberly from one to the other.
"I'm not talking about anything he owes England. That's beside the point,"
Tudsbury said, striking his empty glass on the table.
"It's his responsibility to the American people, as their leader, to ring the alarm and get them cracking, if they're to save their own hides."
"What about the Chicago quarantine speech?" Sloat said. "That was over 2 years ago, and he's still trying to live down the warmonger charges. A leader can't dash ahead around the bend and out of sight. The people still haven't gotten over their disgust with the First World War. Now here's another one, brought on by stupid French and British policy. It's not the time for singing over there, talkie. It just won't work."
"And while Roosevelt watches his timing," said Tudsbury, "Hitler will take half the world. Pamela, be a love and get me another drink. My leg's killing me."
"All right."
Pamela docilely walked to the bar. Tudsbury turned to Henry.
"You know the Nazis. Can Roosevelt afford to wait?"
"What choice has he? A few months ago, Congress was fighting him just on selling you guns."
"A few months ago," Tudsbury said, "Hitler wasn't overrunning Belgium, Holland, and France, and directly facing you across the water."
"Lot of water," said Pug. Sloat slowly beat two fingers with one, like a professor. "Talkie, let's review the ABCs. The old regimes are simply not competent for the industrial age. They're dead scripts, molted skins. Europe's made a start on replacing them by a lot of wholesale murder, the usual European approach to problems, and that's all the First World War was about, and then by resorting to tyrannies of the left or the right. France has simply stagnated and rotted. England's played its same old upper-crust butterfly comedy while soothing the workers with gin and the dole. Meantime, Roosevelt has absorbed the world revolt into legislation. He has made America the only viable, modern, free country. It was a stupendous achievement, a peaceful revolution that's gutted Marxian theory. Nobody wholly grasps that yet. They'll be writing books about it in the year 2000. Because of it, America's the power reserve of free mankind. Roosevelt knows that and moves slowly. It's the last reserve available, the last best hope. Tudsbury was screwing all his heavy features into a mask of disagreement.
Wait, wait, wait. To begin with, none of the New Deal issued from this great revolutionary's brain. The ideas flooded into Washington with the new people when the administration changed. They were quite derivative ideas, mostly copied from us decadent butterflies. We were a good deal ahead of you in social legislation. Ah, thank you, Pam. Now, this slow-moving can be good politics, but in war it's a tactic of disaster. Fighting Germany one at a time will just go down one at a time, which would be a rather silly end to the English-speaking peoples.
We have theater tickets. Come and have dinner with us, Sloat said, standing and stretching out a hand to Natalie, who rose too. We're going to Lescargot.
Thank you. We're dining with Lord Burnwilk, and hoping to inveigle Pug Henry into joining us.
Sloat bought Natalie as luxurious a dinner as Washington offered, with champagne, took her to a musical comedy at the National Theatre, and brought her back to his apartment, hoping for the best. In a common enough masculine way, he thought that, if all went well, he could win her back in one night. She had once been his slave. How could such a feeling disappear? At first, she had seemed just another conquest. He had long planned a prudent marriage in his 30s to some girl of a rich or well-connected family after he had had his fun. Natalie Jastrow now put him in a fever that burned up all prudent calculations. Leslie Sloat had never wanted anything in his life as he wanted Natalie Jastrow. Her distracted, lean look of the moment was peculiarly enticing. He was quite willing to marry her, or do anything else, to have her again. He opened his apartment door and snapped on lights.
Ye gods, a quarter to one. Long show. How about a drink?
I don't know. If I'm to search around tomorrow in New York courthouses for Aaron's documents, I'd better get to bed.
Let me see his letter again, Natalie. You mix us a couple of shorties.
All right. Removing his shoes, jacket, and tie, Sloat sank into an armchair, donned black-rimmed glasses, and studied the letter. He took one book after another from the wall, heavy green government tomes, and drank and read. The ice in both drinks tinkled in the silence. "Come here," he said. Natalie sat on the arm of the couch under the light. Sloat showed her, in a book, State Department rules for naturalized citizens living abroad more than 5 years. They forfeited citizenship, but the book listed 7 exceptions. Some seemed to fit Aaron Jastrow's case, as when health was a reason for staying abroad, or when a man past 60 and retired had maintained his ties with the United States. "Aaron's in hot water on 2 counts, Sloat said. "There's this joker about his father's naturalization. If Aaron actually wasn't a minor at the time, even by a week or a day, he isn't an American, technically, and never has been one. But even if he has the 5-year problem. I mentioned this to him once, you know. I said he should go back to the United States and stay a few months. I'd just seen too many passport messes crop up on this point, ever since the Nazis took over Germany. Sloat picked up the glasses, went to his kitchenette, and mixed more drinks, continuing to talk. Aaron's been a fool, but he's far from unique. It's unbelievable how careless and stupid Americans can be about citizenship. In Warsaw, a dozen of these foul-ups turned up every week. The best thing now, by far, is to get the Secretary of State to drop a word to Rome. The day that word arrives, Aaron will be in the clear. Padding to the couch in his stocking feet, he handed her a drink and sat beside her. But trying to unravel any technical problem, however small, through channels, scares me. There's a monumental jam of cases from Europe. It could take Aaron 18 months. I, therefore, don't think there's much point in your digging around in Bronx courthouses for his alien registration and his father's naturalization records. Not yet. After all, Aaron's a distinguished man of letters. I'm hoping the secretary will shake his head in amusement at the folly of absent-minded professors and shoot off a letter to Rome. I'll get on this first thing in the morning. He's a thorough gentleman. It ought to work. Natalie stared at him. He said, "What's the matter?" "Oh, nothing." The girl drank off half her drink, all at once. "It certainly helps to know a man who knows a man, doesn't it? Well, if I'm to hang around Washington till the end of the week, we'll have to get me a hotel room, Leslie. I'm certainly not going to stay here after tonight. I feel damned odd even about that. Maybe I can still try a few of the hotels."
"Go ahead. I was on the phone for an hour. Washington in May is impossible. There are 4 conventions in town."
"If Byron finds out, God help me."
"Won't he believe that I slept on the couch?"
"He'll have to, if he finds out. Leslie, will you get me permission to go to Italy?"
He compressed his mouth and shook his head.
"I told you the department's advising Americans to leave Italy. If I don't go, Aaron won't come home."
"Why? A broken ankle isn't disabling."
"He just will never pull himself together and leave. You know that. He'll dawdle and potter and hope for the best."
Sloat said with a shrug,
"I don't think you want to go there to help Aaron. Not really. You're just running away, Natalie. Running away. Because you're in way over your head with your submarine boy and shattered by losing your father and actually don't know what on earth to do next with yourself."
"Aren't you clever?" Natalie clinked the half-full glass down on the table.
"I'll leave in the morning, Sloat, if I have to stay at the YWCA, but I'll make your breakfast first. Do you still eat your eggs turned over and fried to leather?"
"I've changed very little altogether, darling."
"Good night."
She closed the bedroom door hard.
Half an hour later, Sloat, dressed in pajamas and a robe, tapped at the door.
"Yes?"
Natalie's voice was not unfriendly.
"Open up."
Her faintly smiling face was pink and oily, and over a nightgown she had bought that afternoon, she wore a floppy blue robe of his.
"Hi, something on your mind?"
"Care for a nightcap?"
She hesitated.
"Oh, why not? I'm wide awake."
Humming happily, Leslie Sloat went to the kitchen and emerged almost immediately with 2 very dark highballs. Natalie sat on the couch, arms folded, face shiny in the lamplight.
"Thanks."
"Sit down, Leslie. Stop pacing. That was a mean crack about Byron."
"Wasn't it the truth, Natalie?"
"All right, if we're playing the truth game, isn't it simpler today than it was a year ago for a Foreign Service officer to have a Jewish wife, since the Nazis are now beyond the pale?"
Sloat's cheery look faded abruptly.
"That never once occurred to me."
"It didn't have to occur to you. Now listen, dear. You can feed me stiff highballs and play This Can't Be Love on the phonograph and all that, but do you really want me to invite you into the bedroom? Honestly, it would be a sluttish thing to do. I don't feel like it."
I'm in love with somebody else." He sighed and shook his head.
"You're too damned explicit, Natalie. You always have been. It's coarse in a girl."
"You said that the first time I proposed, sweetie."
Natalie stood, sipping her highball.
"My goodness, what a rich drink. I do believe you're nothing but a wolf."
She was scanning the books.
"What can I read?"
"Oh, Graham Wallace, the very man. I'll be asleep in half an hour." He stood and took her by the shoulders.
"I love you. I'll love you forever, and I'll try every way I can to get you back."
"Fair enough."
"Leslie, I must go to Italy to get Aaron out. Honestly, I feel horrible about my father. He was worrying over Aaron the very day he died. Maybe this is irrational expiation, but I've got to bring Aaron home safe."
"I'll arrange it, if it's arrangeable."
"Now you're talking. Thanks. Good night."
She kissed him lightly, went to the bedroom, and closed the door. He did not rap again, though he read for a long time and had more drinks.
Chapter 28. The vice chief of naval operations for air was drinking coffee with a blond man in a blue Royal Air Force uniform. It was Lord Burnwilk. He nodded at Victor Henry with a faint smile. During their long convivial dinner with the Tudsburys, Burnwilk had said not a word to Pug about this meeting.
"Good morning, Henry. I understand you know the Air Commodore."
The Admiral worked his eyebrows at Pug.
"Yes, sir."
"Good. Have a cup of coffee."
The wiry old man bounced away from his desk to a map of the United States on the wall.
"And let's get at it. Here, here, and here."
His bony finger jumped to Pensacola, St. Louis, and Chicago.
"We've got 53 old-type scout bombers, SBU-1s and 2s, that have been declared surplus. We want to get them back to Chance Vought in Stratford, Connecticut. That's the manufacturer. And get all U.S. Navy markings and special equipment removed. Our British friends will then pick 'em up, as is, and fly 'em to a carrier that's standing by in Halifax. That's the picture. For obvious reasons..."
The Admiral contracted his brows fiercely at Pug.
"Involving the Neutrality Act, this is a touchy business. So the idea is to get this done without leaving a conspicuous trail of blood, guts, and feathers. You can have a plane to take you around, and you should get at it today."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"We have 60 pilots on hand and waiting," said Lord Burnwilk. "How soon do you suppose you could have the planes, Captain Henry?"
Victor Henry studied the map, then turned to the Englishman.
"Day after tomorrow, sir."
"Late afternoon? Would that be convenient?"
"It'll take some time to get off those markings."
The Englishman gave him a stare and then smiled at the vice chief of naval operations. The Admiral remained impassive.
"Day after tomorrow?" said Lord Burnwilk.
"Yes, sir. The stragglers, if any, could come along on the deck of the next available cargo ship."
"Actually, we were thinking in terms of a week from now," said Lord Burnwilk. "We've given some of the flyers leave. It would require a bit of rounding up. How about Wednesday morning? That gives you and us 4 days."
"Very well, sir."
Burnwilk said to the Admiral,
"You do think that's feasible?"
"He says so."
"Well, then I had better get right at this."
As the door closed, the Admiral glared at Victor Henry, with a tinge of humor showing.
"Day after tomorrow, hey?"
"Admiral, I didn't think those pilots were really on hand and waiting."
The two men exchanged a look of insider's amusement. The foreigner had demanded fast action. The U.S. Navy had offered him faster action than he could handle. Very satisfying, and needing no words.
Well, Wednesday's cutting it close enough. Let's have some fresh coffee, hey? Now, this whole thing is a subterfuge.
The Admiral pressed a buzzer.
I suppose you grasp that. The boss man wants it, so that's that. There are a few things you'd better understand, however.
Showing a new grudging cordiality toward Victor Henry, the Admiral explained that the President had elicited from the Attorney General,
probably by twisting his arm pretty damn hard,
the scheme and the ruling for selling these planes to England despite the Neutrality Act. First, the Navy was declaring the aircraft surplus. Second, Chance Vought was accepting them for a trade-in on new F-4Us at a good high price. Chance Vought could afford to do this because it was turning around and selling the old planes to England at a profit. The catch was that the delivery of the F-4Us lay far in the future. Undoubtedly, President Roosevelt was evading the spirit of the neutrality law and the will of Congress by allowing these planes out of the country now. The Army, in particular, would raise a howl. It was very short of aircraft and had a standing request in to the Navy for surplus flying machines of any description.
Now, Henry, there's no question here, and no hope of concealment in the long run. But if it were announced in advance, there'd be a big storm on the front pages. It might not go through, which would be too bad. Any Germans that the Limeys knocked down with those old SBUs, we won't have to fight later. We're not going to stay out of this brawl. The boss man's idea is to get it done and then take what comes. The way the war news is breaking, it may not cause a whisper after the fact. I hope not. However,
the Admiral paused, squinting at Victor Henry over the rim of his coffee cup.
This does involve a chance of congressional investigation. Somebody like you could end up a goat. The President thought you could get the job done, and I concurred. But this is a volunteer job. Strictly volunteer.
Aye, aye, sir, said Pug. I'd better get at it.
Briny, my love. Brace yourself. When you receive this letter, I ought to be in Lisbon. I'm flying to Italy to fetch Uncle Aaron out of there. With luck, I'll be back in 2 months or less. It depends on the earliest boat passage I can get for us, and for that damned library and all those research files. Sweetheart, don't be angry. It's good for both of us to catch our breaths. Your submarine school and even Uncle Aaron's mess are providential. Your father's visit to Miami was an alarm clock, and it rang just in time. My ideas have altered, I must say, since my Radcliffe days when I started the Student Anti-War Committee. I never realized there were people like you, Warren, and your father. I'm sure the stereotyped military men do exist in droves, the hard-drinking, narrow, bigoted nincompoops. I've met a few of those. The new thing is the Henrys. You're peculiarly unobtrusive on the American scene. I don't know just why, but thank God you're there. Darling, weren't you having sober second thoughts about me at Warren's wedding? Honestly, I saw your mother's viewpoint and quite sympathized with her. Why on earth should her little boy Briny want to marry this dusky old Jewess with Rhine maidens like Janice LaCouture so abundant in the United States? Now, mind you, I have not the slightest sense of inferiority. I value my intelligence, and I know I'm a passably attractive dark lady. Being a Jew is an accident to me. It's left little trace on my ideas or my conduct. Too little, I guess. We live in a secular age, and I'm a product of it. The question remains, should you and I try to bridge a big gap of background and interests because of a random encounter and a fantastic physical pull? I'm not backing out, Byron. I love you. But a couple of months to think it over is no hardship. It's a godsend. Now let me quickly tell you what's been happening. I enclosed the letter Aaron sent me that you didn't want to look at. You can ignore his silly words about us. The whole picture of his problem is very clear in it. Leslie Sloat has been absolutely marvelous. You mustn't be jealous of him, Briny. The way you behaved when I left Pensacola was very upsetting to me. I've rejected repeated, almost groveling marriage proposals from this man. I've told him that I love you, that I've promised to marry you, and that he is out. He knows it. Still, he dropped everything to work on Aaron's stupid mess. Never forget that. Word has gone out to Rome from the secretary's office to expedite Aaron's return. It's less than 2 hours to plane time. I'm dashing this off in the airport. I didn't go home. I stopped in New York for a day and bought enough things to see me through the trip. I'm traveling very light. One suitcase. You'll be admitted to that submarine school. I'm positive of that. I know your father wants it desperately, and I think deep down you do too. It's the right thing for you now. When I come back, if you still want me, I'm yours. Plain enough? So courage, and wish me luck. Here I go. Love you, Natalie.
3 days before the start of the submarine course, Byron was sitting in a squalid furnished room over a Chinese laundry in New London, looking through the formidable reading list, when the postman rang. Natalie's large, hurried, special delivery scrawl on the thick envelope promised bad news. Slumped in a ragged armchair amid smells of soap and hot starch from below, Byron read her shocking letter over and over. He was glancing through Aaron's faintly typed sheets when the telephone jarred him.
"Ensign Henry, Chief Schmidt, Commandant's office. Your father's here. He's gone with Captain Tully to inspect the timbre over at Electric Boat. If you want to join them, they're at Pier 6, the Commandant says."
"Thank you."
Sore at being followed even here by his father, hot to vent his anger and disappointment, Byron took 10 minutes to dress and leave. Victor Henry, meanwhile, walking through the new submarine with his classmate, was in high good humor, though red-eyed with lack of sleep. The scout bomber job was done. It had taken a lot of work and travel. A dozen aircraft had been in repair shops, the pilots had been scattered over the countryside, and there was no sense of urgency anywhere. Getting all-night work on the disabled planes, dragging those pilots out of their wives' arms or back from their fishing trips, had been a struggle. Some commandants had asked rough questions. Jiggs Parker, at the Great Lakes Air Station, another classmate of his, had put up a fight to get a written record of the transfer, until Pug had told an outright lie about new top-secret equipment to be tested on the planes, which might be expended in the process. Jiggs had eyed him for a long silent minute, and then given in. Well, white lies were part of security, Victor Henry thought, and Jiggs knew that. Byron caught up with his father and the commandant in the forward torpedo room of the timbre, inspecting the new firing mechanisms.
"Hello, Dad. What brings you here?"
The harsh voice, the look on Byron's face, told Pug something serious was wrong.
"Happened to be not far from here, so I thought I'd mosey over. You met Byron yet, Red?"
"Not yet. I know he passed the physical, and he's in the new class."
Captain Tully offered his hand.
"Welcome aboard, Byron. You're in for a rough couple of months."
"I'll try to survive, sir." At the almost contemptuous words, Red Tully's eyes shifted disapprovingly to the father. Byron followed along on the tour without another word, his countenance white and angry.
"Say, what the devil's the matter with you?" Victor Henry snapped as he and his son came out of the conning tower on the breezy, slippery black deck, leaving Captain Tully below, talking to the skipper. "You'd do well to watch your tone toward your superiors. You're in the Navy now."
"I know I'm in the Navy. Read this."
Pug saw Natalie's name on the envelope Byron thrust out.
Isn't it personal? Still, Byron offered the letter. Victor Henry held the flapping pages in both hands and read them there on the submarine deck. His face was flushed as he handed them back to his son.
Quite a girl. I've said that before.
If anything happens to her over there, I'll hold you responsible, Dad, and I'll never forget it.
Pug frowned at his son.
That's unreasonable. She's gone to Italy because of her uncle.
No. You scared her off by saying I might not get admitted here if I were married. It wasn't true. A lot of the students are married men. If you hadn't come to Miami, I might be one by now.
Well, if I misled her, I'm sorry. I wasn't sure of the criteria. I thought that for hazardous duty they preferred single men, and for all I know, they do, and simply can't get enough. Anyway, this is what you should be doing. She's dead right about that, and I give her credit for realizing it. Possibly I should have butted out, but the decisions you're making now will shape your whole life, and I wanted to help.
It was a wordy speech for Victor Henry, and he spoke without his usual firmness, disturbed by his son's fixed, hostile expression. He felt guilty, an unfamiliar sensation, guilty of interfering in his son's life, and possibly of driving off the girl. Even if Natalie had been wrong for Byron, her sudden flight was a blow that he could feel almost as his son did. Suppose she had been the best thing in the world for the drifting youngster. Suppose, despite all good fatherly intentions, her being Jewish had made a difference. Byron's answer was as sharp and short as his father's had been apologetic and strung out.
"Yes, you helped. She's gone. I'll never forget, Dad."
Red Tully emerged from the conning tower, looked around, and waved.
"Hey, Pug, ready to go ashore?"
Victor Henry said rapidly to his son,
"You're in this now, Briny. It's the toughest school in the Navy. What's past is past."
Byron said, "Let's get off this thing." And he walked toward the gangway. On a hot, beautiful evening early in June, when the newspaper headlines were roaring of the British evacuation from Dunkirk, and Churchill on the radio was promising to fight to the end, on the beaches, in the streets, and in the hills, Victor Henry left for Europe. Rhoda stayed behind, because of the worsening of the war, to make a home for Madeline in New York. Pug had suggested this, and Rhoda had rather enthusiastically agreed. Madeline, a busy and happy young woman, put up no objection. Pug found it surprisingly easy to get a plane ticket at that time into the warring continent, as Natalie had. The hard thing was to get out. Chapter 29 Natalie tried for 5 days to fly from Lisbon to Rome. She finally obtained a plane ticket, but at the last minute it was voided when a large party of boisterously laughing German army officers, obviously full of lunch and wine, streamed through the gate, leaving 20 excluded passengers looking at each other. This soured her on the airlines. Railroad passage across collapsing France was far too risky. She booked passage on a Greek freighter bound for Naples. The wretched voyage took a week. She shared a hot, tiny cabin with a horde of black roaches and a withered Greek woman smelling of liniment. And she scarcely left it, horrid as it was, because on deck and in passageways, the ship's officers and rough crewmen gave her disquieting looks. She could scarcely eat the food. The pitching and rolling kept her awake at night. En route, her portable radio squawked the BBC stories of the French government's flight from Paris, of Italy's jump into the war, and of Roosevelt's words, "The hand that held the dagger has struck it into the back of its neighbor." Natalie arrived in Italy, nervous and exhausted,
with a strong feeling that she had better get Aaron out of Siena at once, forgetting books, clothes, furniture, everything except the manuscript. But once on dry land, after a decent meal or two with good wine and a long, luxurious night's sleep in a large, soft hotel bed, she wondered at her own panic. Neither in Naples nor in Rome was there much sign that Italy was at war. The summer flowers spilled purple and red over stucco walls in bright sunshine, and in crowded streets the Italians went their lively ways as usual. Jocular, sunburned young soldiers had always abounded in Italian trains and cafes. They appeared as unbuttoned and placid as ever. After the long, hot, filthy train ride to Siena, her first distant glimpse of the old town, rising out of the vine-covered round hills, gave her a stifled, bored feeling, almost as Miami streets did. "God, who ever thought I'd come back here?" she said to herself. The hills outside the town already showed the veiled, dusty green of midsummer. In Siena, nothing had changed. The after-lunch deadness lay on the town. Scarcely a dog moved in the empty red streets in the sun. It took her half an hour to find a working taxicab. Aaron, in his broad-brimmed white hat and yellow Palm Beach summer suit, sat in his old place in the shade of the big elm, reading a book. Beyond him, over the ravine, the black-and-white cathedral towered above the red-roofed town.
"Natalie, you made it! Splendid!"
He came stumping toward her on a cane, with one foot in a metal-framed cast.
"I called and called for a taxicab, but when it was time for my nap, none had come. I did have a wonderful nap. Come inside, my dear. You'll want some refreshment. Giuseppe will see